My third speaker is Dr. Gilbert Kadiagala, who's a professor of international relations and director of the Center for the Study of the United States at the University of Wits. And he's also having extensive research on African politics, peace promotion in Africa, and regional cooperation.
Greetings to all. I want to thank APRM and its partners for the invitation to participate in this event. What I want to do is to put down two big points before I try to answer some of the questions that the organizers gave us. My first point in my entry point in the discussions is to say that global events of the COVID-19 nature, I think, produce momentous opportunities to rethink how we organize our lives. I think we are going to look at a major paradigm shift in policies, but it's also in our approaches to how things are organized. And I want to liken it to the Great Depression in the 30s that gave us the welfare state, which was a real big invention in terms of how societies organize themselves. So I think the positive element about COVID-19, therefore, is giving us the opportunity potentially to be more innovative, to learn more about how we run our societies. So that is the first point. The second one is a crisis such as this, such as the COVID-19, also produce many ideas. They produce a lot of knowledge, a lot of descriptions and prescriptions about what needs to be done. But the proliferation of ideas and knowledge about this crisis has two components, one which is negative and the other one which is positive. And on the negative side, I want to pick up on what my colleague Salim was talking about. I think COVID-19 has occasioned a lot of ideas and a lot of knowledge, a lot of information. So, but the problem is that we need to be very careful whether, in fact, what is being produced about this crisis is actually knowledge or simply information. And I think part of the problem of information is that there are too many actors, there are too many people who are providing a lot of information that may not necessarily amount to useful knowledge. And I think that's what Salim was telling us about the distinction between truth and knowledge. So I think the danger of the overproduction of information about COVID-19 is that it is producing what I call instant ideas about how to organize life. And some of these may not be as useful and may not be as productive. I think knowledge will only emerge after the information that is out there has been scientifically tested, after we have had sufficient time to digest this information, to test its validity, to confirm its assumptions, and therefore to make it useful knowledge. So I'm cautioning that a lot of the information that is being produced about COVID-19, we have to be very careful about how we use it. On the positive side, however, I think the crisis has galvanized our attention about how to generate new ideas that are going to help us in problem solving. I think the galvanization of attention is also important in leading us to action, jump-starting the kinds of policy initiatives, I think, that are going to be important, whether we are talking about new vaccines, whether we are going to talk about new policy frameworks that are going to be important. So the two broad points about the crisis are very simply needs to lead us into the discussion about, if we are talking about new knowledge about COVID-19, who are the producers of this knowledge? Are they experts informed by knowledge that is useful, or are they just people who are providing information that may not be as useful? Secondly, who benefits from this knowledge? And I think we're going to begin to think through, if there is good knowledge about COVID-19, who is it going to benefit? So I thought these introductory remarks would be important to me because they help me structure my responses to some of the questions. I think the first question that I want to respond to is, what are the knowledge systems that are critical at this point as we respond to the crisis? I think my first point here is we need knowledge systems about how to construct capable states that have three facets. I think we need to begin to think about knowledge about how states can be constructed that can have a reach and a resonance across our societies. I think we are struggling now with the question of government capacity as we respond to the crisis. So we should be challenged to begin to think about states that have a wider reach and resonance in our societies. Secondly, as we think about capable states, we should be thinking about states that have authority to make consistent and rapid decisions that have implications for our wider society. So I think it's important as we look at reconfiguring our states, we should ask how authoritative are our states going to be. Thirdly, I think as we think about capable states, we should be thinking about how do we create states that are more trusted. The more trust we have of our institutions, I think the better we are in addressing the bigger problems and challenges that we face. If we don't have institutions that don't have trust, I think we may not be able to create capable states. So that's why I think we need more knowledge about states that are trusted, but they are also authoritative. Secondly, I'm interested in knowledge about building humane societies. Why do we get distracted often from the primary objective of creating societies that are inclusive? I think COVID-19 forces us to go back to the drawing board. If we are confronted with emergencies of this nature in future, how do we deal with them without having created the very infrastructure of humane and caring society? So I'm arguing that we should go back to that broader objective of issues of equity, issues of inclusiveness. These need to be the primary priorities as we deal with the crisis. Thirdly, we need knowledge about resilience. How have our societies been able to overcome adversities? How do we come up with creative knowledge about how our people have overcome all these problems in the past? And where do we go from here? I think resilience is a word that keeps coming up now as we confront the crisis. Dr. Ahmed has already mentioned that given our vulnerability to disasters and diseases, why haven't we invested in public health systems that work? Why haven't we invested in knowledge and training about public health? And I think the more knowledge we have about the infrastructure of public health, the more training we have in that field, I think, is going to help. Why haven't we prioritized community health as we did in the 60s? I think Africa had very robust community health systems in the 60s, and we lost the ball. Why haven't we focused, therefore, on durable health systems that can prevent us from further crises? What about the monitoring systems that will be important about the issues of building capable states, caring societies, and robust healthcare systems? I'm arguing here that we don't really need new monitoring systems. We already have most of these systems. APRM, as was mentioned earlier, is one of the most interesting monitoring systems that African countries have put out there. So we should, in fact, strengthen existing monitoring institutions such as APRM. We should be investing more in capacitating existing institutions, because pretty much we know what the problems are, and our monitoring systems need to be strengthened. My second area of intervention is, how does Africa define itself post-COVID? And again, we've heard from a previous speaker that we are not out of the woods yet. But it's actually not unreasonable to begin thinking about the future. So let me just put a few things about what I think should be the priorities post-COVID. I think one, given the scale of the economic devastation brought by COVID, we should begin thinking about economic reconstruction based on the principles of caring and humane societies. And as I mentioned from my preliminary remarks, that we need to prioritize economic systems that are inclusive. Secondly, we need to begin to think about social engineering around undoing some of the practices that we've been used to. I think we are going to have to spend a lot of time in learning how to permanently social distance, if I can put it very crudely. And that to me is a sense around the notion around social engineering, about undoing some of the practices that have dominated our social life and most of our lives. Thirdly, I think in future and post-COVID, we need to think about new social contracts based on new and shared responsibilities between the leaders and the people. We need a new contract based on shared reciprocities, I think more than ever before. We have to think about, we are in this together, and we have never really created societies that stem from the premise that we are in this together. And so I would want to argue, therefore, that that should be one of the major priorities as we go forward. What is the interface? That's my last intervention here. What is the interface between research and policy? And I want to suggest
1 minute left, Doctor. Sorry.
So 1 minute, yeah. The interface between policy and research is simply that I think we need to be more appreciative of the synergies between research and policy making. COVID-19 is producing good research, but it should also produce policymakers who are able to listen and who are able to pay more attention to the significance of research. But we should also be saying to policymakers, please, please invest more in research, because that has not been the practice before. So let me stop here and give the floor to Sarah. Thank you again.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gilbert. Thank you for all these insightful, points of view and concerning the expenditure on healthcare, but also emphasizing on the social contract and the importance of showing resilience. I hope Professor Eddie Maluka maybe can join us in the Q&A session to give you some, to give all of us and actually share with the with the participants some reflections on our latest activities on resilience, and as well as also in Agenda 2063, we are currently trying to develop a study to assess the implementation of SEPA principles on effective governance for SDGs, which includes one of these principles. Principles is actually inclusiveness, and how countries are adopting a participatory approach and a whole of society approach to implement SDGs, including SDG 3. And definitely with the presence of COVID-19, we decided to give a further focus on the government's responsiveness to COVID-19 at national levels. I think one or two questions. There's a question on the appreciation that we are referring to Africa as a unity, but also the distinction between African countries and also countries that demonstrate Afrophobia or xenophobia, whether at the level of government regulations and laws or within the citizenry. How do we manage the need for unity in this particular moment within this political landscape? Dr. Gilbert.
Thank you for that question. It speaks to the bigger question that we are addressing this week. How can we broaden African unity? And we've been, since 1963, been trying to create the foundations for an integrated Africa. And this is a very lengthy process. We've done some things very well. I think last year, the Continental Free Trade Area gave us some framework for African integration, but we've been also doing other things around the political aspects of integration. So we haven't succeeded in a unity that would subsume all these other identities, like the nation state. So the problem here is that COVID-19 should spur us into more thinking around how we work together on a wide variety of issues, including the science of medicine and so on, public health. That's why the Africa CDC is there. I mean, it's there to give us, provide leadership on how African countries can work together collectively. But I do appreciate that this is still very much a work in progress. We need to do it because doing it as a single nation states is not going to work. And it's been proven consistently that our African economies are too small to hang apart. And that if we are not serious about integration, we are not going to make any sense. So my call here is that we appreciate the problems of integration, but we should keep working at these problems rather than giving up on it. The second question, I think, was on the issue around Malagasy organics. And what I want to say is that I'm not a scientist, but my hunch is that if Malagasy organics are going to work, they should be given time, they should be tested. I think we need scientific knowledge about whether this vaccine or whatever the drug is working or not, rather than politicization of Malagasy organics. Just like we cannot politicize all our indigenous systems of knowledge, we cannot project them as a cure for the disease. I think we should let the scientists sit back and decide whether this thing is going to work. And that's why I was referring to, in terms of, we need more information that is useful, but it can't be useful if it's just being peddled as political ideas. We need good information about whether Malagasy organics work.